Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Marina Shadi.
On the show this week, we hit the road with Panapanahi. Volcanoes become intensely romantic in Fire of Love, and on Film Club we go on an iconic road trip to Paris, Texas. All coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Marina, it's very exciting to have you on this week. This is the first time we've met, even though we've been on many kind of email chains together. For all of the listeners that maybe aren't kind of looking back at the kind of credits of the Little White Lies website, could you explain who you are and what you do?
I'm Marina. I'm a writer. I write film and arts criticism, and I joined Little White Lies just over a year ago now as an editorial assistant. And this is actually my first time recording a podcast on this side of the mic, which feels a bit weird. Because I used to be an editor for the Monstrous Feminine podcast. For anyone listening, if you're into horror movies and feminist film theory, that's one you should check out. I came onto Little White Lies just before we did the June issue. And since then, I've been working with David, Hannah, and Adam. And just being a regular contributor across print and online. And it's been really great. And the other thing that takes up a huge chunk of my time is the work that I do with the collective I'm part of, which is called Endrosha. And we're a group of Cypriot artists and writers. And right now we're working on a site-specific exhibition that's happening in December. And I'm also working on a print publication about the research that's going behind that. So yeah, busy bee, I guess.
Wow, that site-specific exhibition sounds incredible. Where's that going to be?
So that's going to be in Cyprus, unfortunately. So if anyone listening is based in Cyprus, you're free to come, even though I highly doubt it.
We've got Cyprus listeners. I know it.
Oh, do we? Oh, that's good. Okay.
We can do breakdowns. We can see where everyone's listening from. We know. we got the numbers.
Well, I know it's under great lock and key as to what the new issue is about, but how is issue? Is it 92 that's coming out?
No, 96, in fact. We are working on that now. And it's, yeah, we're trying to keep, we try and keep things hush-hush. Except, you know, that there are a few kind of need to know people who are on the inside who we can tell and who are helping us out. And it's it's going to be quite a lavish and beautiful issue, I think. And I think maybe you can take that as a little super obscure clue as to what kind of film that might entail and what kind of filmmaker we might be repping for in the September, October period. So I'll say no more.
Gotta say I was quite surprised by the choice when I found, but I will kind of keep my inside scoop to myself.
I was surprised too, I'm not gonna lie.
Well, I mean, maybe we shouldn't be surprised because nobody guessed it was going to be 50th anniversary of Pink Flamingos with the last one, so you're keeping us on our toes.
Exactly.
And before we move on, I just thought it might be worth mentioning that the Venice Film Festival's lineup got announced yesterday. We at the podcast are going to be doing some special episodes live from the Lido. It does seem to be one of the most stacked lineups in recent memory. Is there anything that you guys saw coming out that you're excited by? I'm kind of bragging since neither of you are going and it's just me. But yeah, like, anything you think I should catch?
I think you should just like stay in your flat and drink aperitivos and not watch anything and, you know, wait until we have to see it at the LFF. I think that there's... It's interesting because I thought, yeah, it's a really, you know, big, high profile, probably, you know, going to be loads of great stuff there lineup. Like, not that many surprises. I think the one surprise for me is, like, there's a new, like, Frederick Wiseman film there, who is one of my favorite, like, documentary makers. He's making documentaries, like, regularly since the 60s, and he's got this very kind of... rigorous mode of observation, and he's actually made for this film, for this festival, a fiction film, which is very, very rare for him. He's done it like once or twice in the past, but he kind of like almost like sweeps those aside a bit, like very rarely talks about them. People very rarely ask him about them. So like, yeah, it's only like a 60-minute as well, so it's going to be a perfect little kind of amuse-bouche for everyone. And also very excited for a Joanna Hogg Haunted House Tilda Swinton movie. So, very, very excited to see that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of 3-hour runtimes. So I think Joanna Hogg blessing us with a nice 90 minutes was very, very welcome.
Oh, yeah. Inuritu is 3 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And he goes, you know, really quite far end of the spectrum for me. So this is either going to be a really like transcendent experience or just a complete slog. Marina, what about you? Anything that kind of piqued your interest?
I mean, New Schrader. Mm. It's always exciting.
What's it called? I saw the Master Gardener.
With my beloved Joel Edgerton.
The trailer for Tar, the Todd Field, Kate Blanchett, like a music drama type of thing. It's very cryptic. I much enjoyed that trailer.
So it looks like a biopic, but it's actually a fictional film.
Interesting. The announcement of it from was quite strange, because sometimes they give away quite a bit of information when they're telling you what films are on and sometimes not. And this one, he kind of just like, she's a conductor, she's brilliant. Maybe she's attracted to the cellist. Maybe she's attracted to the violinist. I'm just like, is this just going to be seeing us kind of Kate Blanchett work her way through a series of lovers in an orchestra, which, you know,
I mean,
also 3 hours long.
Oh, is it 3 hours?
No. So.
Okay. Well, I was just about to say that it kind of teeters on awards bait looking to me, but now you've said it's 3 hours, I instantly renege that thought.
Well, I was most interested to see that Lars von Trier is premiering a new show there. Apparently some people have seen the first episode and it's absolutely astonishing.
Well, so... I love The Kingdom is one of his, like, he did two series of The Kingdom, like, way, way back before he did, like, The Idiots and... I think certainly in Denmark, it was the thing that really made his name. It's an amazing, show. And actually, like, fact fans, the Alex Garland film Men, absolutely. I know a lot of people have said that it felt like a real homage to Lars von Trier, especially films like Antichrist. But actually, it's the Kingdom is the one thing that he's like really in its finale, he's ripping off the Kingdom like lock, stock and barrel. I don't want to say any more than that, but I think you can, if you've seen Men, you probably can guess what I'm talking about. I'm super excited for the new one. But also because I interviewed him for the house that Jack built, and it was one of the most strange experiences because he seemed extremely frail. He was kind of, he's in his 60s, but he seemed like he was in his 80s when I spoke to him, because I think years of drinking and have taken him, and pills and things have taken a massive toll on him. So for me, it's like very heartening that he is able to actually make a big thing like this again. I did wonder if he had any more films or work in him when doing that interview, but obviously he does, which is good.
Oh, well, hopefully this won't be kind of the last that we see from him. As much as he's a, you know, rightly controversial figure, I do always find myself rooting for Lars. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view to the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to the Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Hit the Road follows a chaotic, tender family that is on a road trip across the rugged landscape of Iran, all while fussing over a sick dog and getting on each other's nerves. Slowly it emerges what they are driving to the Turkish border for. So Marina, this is kind of, in many ways, a classic road movie. What kind of elements do you think work to make a great road trip movie?
That's a really good question. I think the thing that made it work the most as a road movie for me is how, in general, cars in Iranian cinema and literature are always this, like, private space that can be quite liberating for its characters. So I thought that was a really clever way to incorporate this kind of political turmoil within the private space of a car. I also, this film was somehow branded as like the Persian Little Miss Sunshine, which to me was a little bit like saying that this foreign thing is like a derivative version of this like great Western road movie. But also I didn't feel like it was anything like Little Miss Sunshine. Did you guys get that?
I completely agree with you. I don't think it has that tweeness.
I mean, on the most superficial levels, in that it's funny and there's people in a family in a car, yes. But I think as films, they're like tonally and what they're trying to say. Yeah, you couldn't get further apart on the scale, really.
But beyond kind of that kind of level of like, oh, it's the car is kind of the sacred space where they can kind of be themselves, I suppose, a little bit kind of cut up from the world. Like, did you enjoy this element of like, you know, I suppose a journey through Iran, because those landscapes to me was so incredible as well.
Yeah, it was absolutely beautiful. And I think, I mean, paired with the soundtrack, which was this like, so pre Iranian revolution, so pre-1979, like pop songs and ballads, which are obviously now banned if you get caught in Iran driving around and listening to those songs, like that's not allowed. So I think paired with that, it just like gave it such a like splendor with the landscape and just like beautiful vistas and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely stunning. It does kind of feel like the most bittersweet love letter to Iran in a strange way. But David, I think it's worth kind of getting a bit of background on this. The director's father is the acclaimed director Jafar Panahi, and he's been arrested. Could you kind of explain what the situation is?
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite awful, to be honest. He's been a filmmaker. He's been making films since the kind of early mid 90s. And you know, has been one of the real kind of linchpins of like the, you know, the so-called new Iranian cinema, known for films like The Mirror and The White Balloon, and also just sort of making these very small dramas out of seemingly nothing. He actually did a film a few years ago. Going back a bit further, around 2009, 2010, he was placed under house arrest in Iran for some kind of trumped up sedition charge. He made this incredible film called This Is Not a Film entirely in his house, which again, very innovative and poetic film, challenging the bounds of censorship, questioning like what art is and what the confines of art can be, and has kind of been sort of making these sort of guerrilla stealth movies in the preceding years. One of the main ones being a film called Taxi Tehran, which is in a way tonally a bit of a sort of sets a bit of a precedent for Hit the Road, in that it is kind of funny, bittersweet film about a taxi driver going around Tehran picking up various people and having interactions with them, and through the kind of confines of a car you are getting a kind of reflected view of society through all these kind of interactions, and done in this very kind of like charming, naturalistic, but also very kind of politically canny and poetic way. Recently, another director, Mohammed Rasulov, also was arrested. He's also someone who's a really interesting filmmaker, who's had films, play at various festivals and films really, I think as recent as like a year ago, I think he's had a film released in the UK, and when sort of protesting this trumped up arrest, Panahi was arrested himself, and is now just suddenly facing a 6-year prison term, which is kind of devastating. And this has obviously come after his son Panah Panahi has made this movie, which perhaps resonates even further, because now you've got this idea of like, well, this is the film. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but like there is a kind of sunny exterior to the film that has a very kind of dark core about kind of families being torn apart, people having to act in very kind of sudden and damaging ways, and the dangers of fighting for personal liberty and for what you believe in oppressive regimes. That all of that stuff is very central to the kind of, why we're here and why we're on this road trip. I think it's worthwhile talking about Jafar and his kind of, journey and current like horrendous situation, because it all feeds into this portrait of Iran at the moment, and the toils of being an artist in Iran.
Yeah, it's a strange perspective that the film takes in a way, because
I think I said in my review that this is another big win for nepotism, which was partly said in jest, but in a way with this added context now, with Panahi Sr. being incarcerated, his son carrying that baton forward and also doing a great job at it, and having his own unique directorial style, even though it's very influenced by like Iranian New Wave and the work of his father, and also like there's hints of Kiarostami in there as well, but it does have this like distinctive directorial voice behind it, and it's also very prescient and very, important for Iranian cinema, especially at the moment.
Yeah, I'm wondering, within that style, he has these kind of like touches of, I suppose, magical realism. Did those elements also work for you?
Yeah, I think, because there's like a kid in this movie who's just like so hyperactive and like it's just like explosive energy, and this like magical realism sequence that I don't want to give away what it is, but I feel like it really complements his energy and this view of the future of Iran and, you know, what could be.
Yeah, it's totally about a kind of, you know, this sort of need to sort of descend into fantasy sometimes, and like there's something quite sort of, you know, there's something quite bittersweet about this interlude that is on the surface seems very funny and eccentric, but actually in retrospect is quite sad, in that this is like a kind of this world of fantasy is like the only kind of safe space for people as a form of expression. So to also add, like, this kid is hyperactive, but it's an incredible, that, you know, the performance is just peerless. Like how he got the kid to act like that, how the kid learned lines. Like, I mean, it's not only that, you know, he's funny in and of the moment, and they're cutting out. It's not like kind of TikTok humor where it's like, oh, kid says one funny thing, lol. I mean, he is doing like long takes, long conversational dialogue scenes where he's memorizing like pages and pages of dialogue. Like, how? Just like it's jaw dropping.
It really is. But I just kind of still left with this kind of intense feeling of melancholy, I suppose, because the kind of perspective of the film is not just about the person who's leaving. It's more interested in the people that are left behind and what it's like to kind of almost be grieving someone whilst you're still with them, because the inevitable is just around the corner. But yeah, I thought it was a stunning film, and I'm kind of quite depressed to hear it described as Iranian Little Miss Sunshine, because I think it was, which is actually a film that I do think is perfectly sweet. But
I think we have to acknowledge that this is the dark arts of the marketing people, and that if this is a way to get people into the cinemas to see this film, then so be it. You know, like that. Fair enough.
Well, on that note, we will join the dark arts of the marketing people and put some scores on this. Marina, would you give it in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
So in anticipation, I'll give it a 3, and that's because I'm always a bit wary of someone coming from a background where they grew up around, you know, they've got this legacy to follow. So, yeah, in anticipation, it was a 3. Then enjoyment in retrospect, 4 for me. I really appreciated the balance of, you know, this really serious political context and the levity that was... I thought it was a really clever balancing act, but the pace, I thought, was a tiny bit uneven. But nevertheless, I'm really excited to see... what he's got up his sleeve.
David, what about you?
Yeah, I'd go for same Z's. Yeah, it's really it's I think in the end it's a kind of, I mean, sorry to sort of labor the whole Little Miss Sunshine thing, but I think that one of the reasons why we have kind of like flagged that up is because like this is very much not a kind of Hollywood treatment of the subject, in that it's done in a very unsentimental way, and I think that it isn't. I think one of the film's strengths is kind of acknowledging the fact that it's operating in a more kind of refined and unsentimental way, and in the kind of telling of this story as something that is kind of like part of life rather than like this great horrendous tragedy. And like the thing that actually makes it most moving is the way that how the characters are quite naturally accepting and philosophical about this situation, rather than like, you know, clawing their eyes out and going, why? So like, sorry, the listeners can't hear that I'm shaking my fist at the ceiling there for emphasis. But yeah, so that's that's me on that one.
I think 4's across the board for me. I had quite a few people who saw this at Cannes who said that they thought it might be right up my street. And yeah, it certainly delivered. It's, you know, I'm not normally that big of a fan of a coming of age film, because I think they kind of speak to an experience that I didn't really have. I didn't feel like there was one moment where all of a sudden that I was an adult. But yeah, this is kind of more of a portrait of a family, and a kind of and of loss, I thought was absolutely beautiful. So if you've got thoughts on these movies, you can email us at TCO London or tweet us at LWLies. Fire and Love.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Follows the lives and careers of volcanologists Katia and Maurice Kraft, who love two things, volcanoes and each other. Earlier this week, I caught up with director Sara Dosa to talk about her remarkable documentary.
So yeah, I guess we'll start at the beginning. How did you first come to the story of Katia and Maurice?
I first learned about Katia and Maurice when I was doing research for the last film I directed. That film is called The Seer and the Unseen, and it tells the story of an Icelandic woman who's in communication with spirits of nature. Which is a very common belief there and around the world. We think of it as a magically real documentary, mm-hmm. and it opens with kind of the story of Iceland, how Iceland was created, and when humans first came to Iceland. And we wanted archival imagery of erupting volcanoes to kind of set this tone of, you know, of creation and destruction, and there's a live Earth. And so we started researching erupting volcanoes, Iceland, you know, those were our search terms. And when you do that, especially looking for images from the 60s and 70s, you come across Katia and Maurice. But it really wasn't until we learned about them as people that we got super hooked. I mean, their images were spectacular. But once we learned that they were a couple in love, that they were incredibly playful and funny, that they were philosophical, mm-hmm. and also like they seemed to take their work very seriously, but not themselves. We thought these are people whose worlds we want to dwell within. And for me, that's always like the sign of a hint that I might want to make a film. Yeah. I have a kind of funny thing that I call like a road trip test, where I think like where I'm starting to contemplate a new film. I'll think like, would I want to go on a road trip with these people? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yes, then I kind of go to the next phase. And I imagined going on a road trip with Katia and Maurice, and I thought, oh my God, that would be the most fun road trip ever. So all of those things kind of got the ball rolling, and and kind of inspired the impetus for the film.
And when you then kind of go into the footage, or when you're doing the research with the ESO, was there like a key piece of footage that kind of sparked your interest in being like, this is particularly gorgeous, this is cinema, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, there was so much of that. It actually kind of started with their writing, though. Like, mm-hmm. we knew that their footage was going to be amazing, but in one of the books that they wrote, they authored nearly 20 books, aside mm-hmm. from the hundreds of hours that they filmed footage. But in one book, Maurice wrote a sentence where he says, for me, Katia and volcanoes, it is a love story. And that line is now at the very end of the film. But for us, it was kind of like a genesis point where we thought, like, oh, that's the framework for this film. It's a love story that feels very true to them. But it's also, Maurice is talking about a love triangle. You know, it's not just the love of his partner in life. It's the love with this third love, a volcano. And we thought that could be a really playful framework for exploring a story about the human relationship with the natural world. And so looking through their footage with that in mind, it served as a prism. You know, we're looking for imagery that felt like love, you know, sparks flying, you know, geothermal bubbles percolating, eruptions crescendoing. That there's, it was very clear that volcanoes were their object of their desire, their absolute passion, but also volcanoes were kind of a love language for their human relationship too. So that guided our process as we started to structure the film. There is certain scenes that absolutely stood out. For example, the scene of when they go to a place called Kawi Ijen or the Green Crater in Indonesia in 1971. It's not an erupting volcano, but it's a lake of pure sulfuric acid that Maurice takes, you know, a rubber boat on. And that story was so intriguing to us because it illuminated so much of their relationship dynamic. Maurice wants to go out on this raft. Katya does not want him to. Maurice really wants to because it's you know, he says it's for scientific purposes to collect data at the bottom of the sulfuric lake, but it's really for the thrill of the adventure. Katya feels like it'll jeopardize kind of the legitimacy of their scientific work. So it's a moment of tension in the relationship, but visually it's so stunning. The greens, the yellows, the reds, the way that they capture this sulfuric world was stunning to us, and also was able to contrast with some of the erupting volcano footage. We were worried that audiences would get like eruption fatigue, and so we were grateful for another kind of texture. I still watch that footage, and I can't believe that they ventured to, or specifically Maurice ventured to do something so dangerous, and that they captured it on film. But yeah, it could go on and on. There's so many examples of those scenes.
But so much of it looks like space exploration. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't it? Has a really like otherworldly quality. As much as we know about volcanoes, they're so unfamiliar and mysterious in a weird way.
Yeah, absolutely. They are. They're so surreal. That was one of the things my team my two editors, Aaron Casper and Jocelyn Chaput, and my producers, Shane Boris and Ina Fishman, and also my kind of everybody, my executive producers, Greg Boosted and Jessica Hara from Sandbox Films. Like, it was a very collaborative process of making the film, and I really want to like celebrate and shout out their efforts. But Jocelyn and Aaron and I, we watched everything, and we were constantly just like blown away by the surreality of the footage. It really did feel like we were in outer space. But the fact that it was Earth made it all the more interesting and intriguing to think like, oh my God, our planet looks like this. The Earth is this powerful. It's this sentient. Sentient is often a word I like because it communicates life force and intelligence that's beyond the human. And that's something that Maurice and Katya contended with all the time, is just like how alive volcanoes seem to be, but beyond the human. And that comes across in the imagery in such intriguing ways. So much of the film is about mysteries, you know, it's about going towards the unknown, all the while knowing that, you know, you can never quite understand. Like, Katya and Maurice would often say, volcanoes are beyond human understanding, beyond human comprehension. They're just so vast. Maurice would lament that the human eye can't see in geologic time. There was, like, kind of the Sisyphean struggle that they had, but they still went towards. They still yearned to understand regardless, because that journey brought them such meaning and adventure and love. But I feel like that yearning, and I feel like that quest towards the mysteries really do show up in the landscapes that they captured, and just their way too, like the gaze behind the camera as well. I feel like you can really feel that.
It's strange that, you know, obviously this is like language, we're talking about volcanoes, but even when you're describing that bond, it seems like intensely romantic. Like, yes. You are talking, when you talk about it being a love triangle, like that, the passion that they have there, yeah. Really
seems very like profound. Like you're talking about the mysteries of the bond with the volcano, and it's kind of like the mysteries of what is love, what is finding your soulmate.
I think that was one of the things we were so inspired by in their story that felt so so organic and true to their lived experience. That for us, we were imagining like the utter trust you must need to have in your partner. You know, there's a scene, for example, in Indonesia in 1979. They're meeting the Anak Krakatoa volcano, which is just erupting constantly, throwing volcanic bombs like every few minutes. And one of them was asleep, and one of them had to kind of keep watch. And the trust that they had to have, because the person who was awake would have to like move the person sleeping out of the way at all times, and that trust in your person to like save your life just has to be so profound. You have to be so in sync in those moments. But there's something too about kind of what they witnessed and sharing that level of experience with another person that just does seem so deeply romantic. Like Captain Maurice didn't use spiritual language, but I really feel like the way they describe volcanoes was akin to how so many people talk about experiences with the divine. You know, Katya says in the film, like, she can't see the world anymore. It's mediocrities. Like, I feel like she looked into the face of the gods and goddesses and experienced something so transcendent that it's just like she can never be normal again. And the fact that she could do that with her life partner, they could share in that kind of moment. It's like that's a level of understanding that they just don't have with other humans. It's almost like being anointed, or there's all kind of, yeah, I'm again, like fumbling through spiritual languages, but that's kind of what seemed fitting. They were just able to be on a different plane with each other because of what they experienced and because of what they encouraged and emboldened in each other. And there is something so romantic about that, to think that, you know, there is another person who can understand you and hold you in those moments and experiences in life too.
On kind of more of a technical level, like you have all these footage which is going up to 1991 with, you know, the terrible tragedy. Was there like technical challenges in like adapting that footage and kind of, you know, working with it all, because it was it all in perfect nick, or was it a struggle?
Yeah, that's specifically the 1991.
Well, generally all of the footage that they kind of accumulated over their lives.
Yeah, it was, there was a lot of technical challenges. They mostly shot in 16mm that was scanned beautifully by Image Est, the archival facility in France that we were working with. They helped us actually kind of troubleshoot some of the technical issues. But there are all kinds of challenges. One of them being that none of the 16mm footage arrived to us with sound. It was all silent. and my editors had to rebuild these soundscapes very diligently, which they loved. That was actually, I mean, it was incredibly hard work and very challenging for them, but they're the type of meticulous editors that also really enjoy and feel satisfied by that kind of detailed-oriented work. Immensely challenging. And through through the years, the technical formats would change, and so we would work with, you know, different types of video formats. Oftentimes the video that we were working with was also shot by television crews that were filming Katya and Maurice and came to us in much lower quality that was hard, because when we were so spoiled by these gorgeous images of the celluloid, that to get kind of highly pixelated, fuzzy video footage from the 80s, it was very frustrating, but we tried to just kind of embrace those technical challenges or those differences in format as the making of a collage film, mm-hmm. and each different piece feeling like it could speak to a different time and place, and the seams being exposed actually kind of spoke more about our process, hopefully not in a way that would be distracting, but it could almost feel like geologic layering, you know, yeah. Like here's the Cenozoic, here's the Devonian era, you know. I'm being kind of silly, but we did kind of think of things, trying to find kind of geologic parallels to our own process of sifting through kind of the materials that Katya Maurice left behind. So yeah, those are some of the kind of tech challenges. We had a lot more, but I'll leave you with those.
But you've also got this very distinctive narration from Miranda July. I'm wondering what you think that it is that she brought in terms of a narrator to the story.
I love Miranda.
We all love Miranda.
She, we wanted, when we realized we needed a narrator, which was early on in the process, we wanted an inquisitive narrator who could hold space for Katya and Maurice, their voices, of course, but also their images, and someone who could approach them, yeah, with the kind of curiosity of a searching scientist, too. I feel like Miranda does such an incredible job of expressing curiosity and warmth and intimacy and vastness all at once. Like, she's such a talented actor, and she's such a brilliant artist in the way she plays with these themes of kind of what it means to be human and in relationship and alive. And so for all those reasons and so many more, we thought that she would be a good narrator. One of our editors, Jocelyn Chapu, she actually was our temporary narrator, and she was channeling the narration style of Godard's Masculine and Feminine, which is a very deadpan voice. And we thought, again, like that kind of almost like neutral stance. Well, first we wanted to pay homage to the French New Wave, which inspired Katya and Maurice, and so that's a big kind of influence on our film. But we thought like that kind of restrained tone, again, would, yeah, make more space and for the imagery to be felt. Miranda was kind of also playing into what she had inherited from Jocelyn, but she made it her own with a lot more warmth. We never wanted like kind of this deadpan voice to feel like too neutral or cold. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Miranda is so skilled at what we call deadpan curiosity. She did a wonderful job of in our minds of elevating that. But it felt like a bold choice. We were definitely like making a statement with that. It's you can't. She's not a narrator who's going to be like wallpaper. I'm really grateful for her collaboration.
And finally, you know, like this has been so well received. I think you're about 100% on Rotten Tomatoes or something, and it's getting like, you know, for a documentary, it's getting like a really great release. Do you have any sense of what it is, perhaps, that people are really connecting to in this story that it's being so well received?
And first, I'm so shocked and surprised, but incredibly grateful for the reception. I just had no idea what to expect once we finished the film. I think people are really connecting to Katya and Maurice's, not just their story, but their imagery. I mean, it's spectacular. It's of volcanoes, but also there's such unmistakable love behind the frame. Mm-hmm. I feel like the way their portraiture of the earth is just infused with passion in a way it's like you can feel on some sort of like instinctual level. It's like the images themselves are beautiful, but there's like that emotion and that feeling that I feel like is only conjured by like the person recording the material. And I feel like that really comes across. And I think that audiences are picking up on that. But it's just so shocking that people would get so close to something so dangerous. I think another thing too that audiences have been kind of sharing with me in Q&As or after screenings is kind of some of the existential questions that permeate the film about, you know, what it means to live a meaningful life, what any moment could be your last, what it means to be a tiny human amid like the scale and scope of geologic time. And I think of course, fear and uncertainty and the unknown abound at all times, but I feel like those themes have crystallized specifically on a global level during the pandemic, and that's the context under which we were making the film. And I think a lot of people have been grappling with their own existential questions and dealing with fear and loss, and Katya and Maurice are such skilled navigators of fear and loss and the unknown. So those are things that have been really meaningful for me to hear of how Katya and Maurice have been kind of inspiring for people in the wake of such a hard time globally. But I think too, like, volcanoes are, they illustrate the sentience of the planet. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that it's challenging to get in contact with, to get to transport people into these surreal landscapes. It seems like that's something that people really enjoy, just knowing like, oh, our Earth can look like that.
So, David, you reviewed for the magazine, and it was quite interesting, this angle that you had, that they were sort of
early influences, should we say, early TikToker daredevils rather than respected scientists?
Oh, no. I definitely wasn't saying that one should cancel out the other. I'm sure that they are extremely respected scientists, and, you know, the film definitely kind of gets that across. I think, so the way that the documentary works is that it is this portrait of this couple, and they are like they've been kind of sorry to again use the sort of Hollywood shorthand, but they feel like they've been kind of transplanted out of a Wes Anderson movie, like a kind of Life Aquatic type deal. They are kind of husband and wife volcanologists who travel around the globe at a moment's notice, and their kink is watching volcanoes from like as close up as possible. As a way to be able to study their movements and the effects, and but also there's part of the film where you're watching where they it's something they act. I mean, I say the kink, I say it's their kink jokingly, but not jokingly, because there's clearly some kind of like erotic fascination with volcanoes. And you know, there are lots of sequences that where, you know, the landscape footage that they're kind of constantly capturing is incredible enough, with like these splodges of magma just sort of rolling, you know, mere feet away from them, and you know, they're kind of like traipsing up a hill, while in the middle distance there is kind of billows of smoke coming out and like rocks flying everywhere, and you know, like they're very, very blasé about death in the film. And yeah, I think I made that point about TikTokers, because like I think that now is a medium that focuses so much on the kind of, I guess, like homespun daredevilry, where you have people like doing tricks on skateboards, or you know, diving off high cliffs into the sea, and there is a kind of like, you know, people are kind of monetizing their willingness to kind of risk their lives. And you could just imagine in the sort of 70s or 80s, if there was a kind of like 16 millimeter equivalent of like Insta stories, these guys would be doing like sick metrics, you know, like they would have like mega followers. It's like, whoa, Katya, look out, you know, she's canoeing on some magma, check this out, you know, like, you know, a million shares, etc. You know, so yeah, that's the feeling. That's the kind of feeling I got from the film, actually, which is, I hope not sort of. It's definitely not meant as a reductive reading of the film, because I think that like more. I'm trying to sort of place a kind of contemporary relevance to what it is they did. So that was the why, I guess.
It's very, I now beginning to think this would be a very interesting double bill with Nope, for some of the reasons that but we won't give any spoilers for Nope. I watched this at Sundance in January, and this kind of just struck me as like, it was one of my favorites, and as an intensely romantic story. And there are those great couples of history of, you know, like, Diego and Frida and the Curies, you know, people like that, where they kind of, it seems so much more like soulmate because their passions align so much. And that was just really beautiful to me. Like, Marina, did you kind of buy into the kind of love story of it all?
I mean, yeah, it's interesting that David, you mentioned it's very like the Life Aquatic. It also slightly reminded me of last year's Jacques Cousteau documentary, both in that you feel like the energy of these like super passionate, super French, super whimsical, like environmentalists, like their energy is just radiating off the screen. They're so passionate, but also on the fact that these are people who've recorded phenomenal footage that has artistic merit beyond being helpful to their own respective fields. In terms of the romance, you know, love them. I did think the narration was a bit invasive and a bit, you know, love Miranda July, did not love her narration as much. I think it was trying to impose the romance a bit too much. And as I was watching, actually, my housemate came in and they were like, they should have gotten Bjork to narrate that. And I was like, yeah, she'd actually be really good, you know, volcanoes.
Well, more Bjork in everything, I think, is generally the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of the footage of itself, I mean, some of it is so incredibly striking. Were there any, like, particular moments that stood out for you? I mean, it's just, some of the ones that stood out to me were just, like, also the catastrophic injuries that they're currently getting, which were just as kind of explosive in a way as the giant magma waterfalls and stuff.
Oh, yeah, when they're in Iceland and he steps in, like, a geyser or something and gets his leg, or molten, or sort of, yeah, red-hot mud and just gets completely, like, yeah. And he's super chill about that. And I mean, I think also beyond Wes Anderson, I think that maybe the more kind of, like, obvious philosophical touchstone is, like, someone like Werner Herzog. And I mean, it's very much a kind of, like, what if Grizzly Man as a love story? I mean, Grizzly Man is his film about kind of, you know, this, his whole thesis about, you know, nature's indifference to humanity, and, like, we can't, that, you know, beyond this kind of romantic ideal we have of, like, animals and landscapes and mastering, being able to master that world, that's just kind of whimsical, that's a whimsical belief, and it can't happen. And, like, in the end, you know, you might think you're, like, making friends with a bear, but the bear's gonna, like, kill you the first opportunity it gets, because it doesn't, you know, it's unfeeling. And, like, I think that I guess the story of the crafts is also about that kind of, you know, the sublime indifference of nature, in that they famously carked it at the hands of one of their beloved volcanoes. I mean, the film deals with their death in a very kind of, like, I mean, it's very sort of sudden and brutal, and almost sort of matter of fact, like the way that it's kind of depicted in the film. I mean, I was quite shocked by how kind of, just, you know, that it was sort of, in the film, it's sort of presented as just another episode in their crazy life. You know,
but it kind of was, I think, even for them, they would have seen it as that, because of course they'd go out like that, you know.
I mean, they were kind of pre-hyping it themselves. I mean, they knew, you know. I mean, to add one bit of context, I guess one of the kind of dramatic arcs in the documentary is that they talk of, like, red volcanoes and gray volcanoes, and, like, the red ones are the kind of beautiful red magma ones that we kind of, you know, that we kind of, you know, that are almost the sort of stereotype of volcanoes. And the first half of the film is very much like, oh, the beauty of nature, the, you know, getting close to these natural wonders. And then the second half, for almost like kind of anticipating what's going to happen, is more about, like, oh, actually, we're focusing more on, like, the dangerous ones, which are the kind of grey ones, which are about, you know, ash and smoke and, you know, these, and wind and all these kind of stuff that are kind of destroying landscapes, and in many cases, like, destroying, like, urban populations. And and the work they were doing was actually to, like, try and help these people in the end, like, that they kind of, it feels like they kind of at one point they purposely pivoted towards trying to be kind of, like, you know, work more on the sort of, like, we're studying these volcanoes to help with, like, safety and to help, like, evacuations and knowing when people can actually be saved. So I think the second half of the film is more kind of, like, I guess, educational doc, informative doc about, like, history, rather than, like, you know, more like it's a National Geographic film, so you do get, you know, there is that focus on like the beautiful nature shots, nature porn, if you will. But yeah, like the reality is that those the grey volcanoes are not beautiful in any way. They're really ugly and horrible. And yeah, as the
I just kind of presumed a level of spiritual connection, I suppose. Perhaps it's just because I'd seen The Northmen that like actually there was something not in a death wish in them, but like something in being devoured by the old volcano that kind of was almost like them ascending to another level.
Oh, totally. It's like kind of blood sacrifice kind of thing. But yeah, like, it, you know, the way they do it is not them kind of, you know, it's like, to give an example, it's not them like, it's unlikely that they realized that this was the end, that they were able to kind of like acknowledge the fact that they were going to be killed by their beloved volcano. It seems that like they were just stood there and it just boomed past them and that was it. Like they maybe weren't able to have that moment of acknowledged transcendence that they may have like thought they might have had, which again is itself quite makes that ending really kind of brutally cold.
I thought it was more like, you know, this was a documentary that was more like celebrating their life and what they shared and what they had and what they did without spending too much time on their death. I thought that was fine. But also, why did they have to make the lava look like it would taste so good? Like, I know it would kill me, but like, I just want to know what it tastes like.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's mesmerizing. You can kind of see what would kind of draw you to this place. It's almost like looking into, right? You know, that footage that we saw of NASA, of the stars. Like, there's just some things in nature that are completely overwhelming to gaze
at. It's true. They look like Skittles, didn't they? You just want to, like, grab them. Come on, Layla, you're a foodie. Which chefs are doing lava cookery, magma dishes?
God, I feel like that's going to be like those kind. You know, you get a lot of these high-end French pâtissier chefs. You're like Alain Ducasse's and stuff, and they often do like an exploding dessert. There's lots of cracking through something and an oozing. That's
fake magma. No, it's true though, actually, because like I think that there is something very edifying and alluring about the image of the sort of the volcano spewing liquid, and erotic in a way. I mean, it's like, I mean, let's not go all Freudian on it, but like, you know, that I think we're kind of I think we're going through the looking glass here on on why the crafts may be loved. Love the volcano so much. There is symbolism beyond their kind of rigorous passions.
I think that this might be a bit of a Rorschach's test, and while some of us are seeing desserts, you're seeing like deeply erotic imagery.
Phallic. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, let's get some scores on this. My goodness, Marina, do you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
So anticipation, I would give it a 4. Enjoyment, I would also give it a 4. I also have to say that the soundtrack on this went so hard, like, especially for a nature documentary. You know, it had some, like, Brian Eno, some, like, Ennio Morricone, some Air. I thought that was, like, it was lovely and also paired with the footage. It was just like breathtaking. But in retrospect, I'd give it a 3. It would easily be a 4 if it was half of its runtime. Obviously, the footage is like breathtaking, and in these like split screen sequences, like the director makes like a stunning use of the material. But it does feel towards the end that you lose a little bit of that investment, in my opinion.
David, what about you?
I think I'm probably going to be a little bit more grouchy on this one and say it's probably 3s for me. Like, I think I want to pick up on something Marina said earlier, that I did feel, and I know that this is probably maybe a personal thing, but like, I did feel that this kind of idea of their sort of star-crossed romance, and having that kind of being reminded of that through Miranda July's voiceover constantly, it did feel invasive, and maybe like pushing that a bit too hard, like to the point, you know, like when someone tells you something so much that you actually start to doubt it. Like, I maybe didn't see enough evidence in the footage itself. You know, that they chose, you know, that it's like, you know, that there's a bit where they find like, oh, look, she gives him a little glance and he gives her a little kind of nudge. And it's like, that's fine, but that's not enough to base an entire film's thesis on, really. So, but yeah, I maybe didn't get, like, I think the star-crossed lovers thing was maybe too much for me.
I was all on board with the star-crossed lovers side of things. Yeah, I think Grizzly Man is an interesting comparison, because that is such a sort of dark heart, and that's such a relationship in which they don't really support each other. She's barely even on camera. So I think maybe compared to that, to me, the little glances still seemed like intensely romantic. And, you know, we're not seeing footage of them on date night. We're seeing footage of them, you know, at work. So, like, you know, I still thought just that connection they had really spoke to me. So, yeah, Sundance, I was very tired, probably 3, 5 in enjoyment. And, yeah, in retrospect, 4. I thought it was lovely, and it's really stayed with me. And I'm glad it seems to have gotten a lot more attention than, you know, many of these documentaries do. Like, it's getting a proper release.
I feel it's going to be one of those films like Free Solo that ends up doing, like, you know, a doc that ends up sort of doing really well. It's sort of ticking quite a lot of boxes, in that it's got the nature, it's got the sort of narrative arc and the romance. And I think that, you know, maybe, I mean, my 3s are high 3s, because I think having had this discussion and being able to kind of like delve into it a bit deeper maybe makes me think, you know, maybe I didn't like it. Maybe I liked it more than I'm getting on. So anyway.
Yeah, it certainly deserves the hype it's getting. Also, I remember this scene where it describes that Katya's more like, you know, studying the like minutiae of like volcanoes. Meanwhile, Maurice is like plunging himself into the lava, and it's like, oh, Katya's like a bird, and Maurice is like a walrus. And I was like, okay, like the two genders of discourse, like bird and walrus, I guess.
I mean, maybe it's for another time, but I watched it with my wife, and she, on that scene, she just looked at me and was like, there's the patriarchy for you. The guy gets to go gallivanting, the woman stays at home, does the work. There you go. Anyway, it was the 70s. Et moi?
Yeah, just being let outside of the house in the 70s.
Exactly.
Paris, Texas focuses on a vagabond named Travis, who years after mysteriously wandering out of the desert, attempts to reunite with his brother and 7-year-old son. After reconnecting with his son, Travis and the boy end up embarking on a voyage through the American Southwest to track down Travis's long-missing wife. So we're back in road trip mode. Possibly one of the greatest road trip movies. You think that's fair to say?
Yeah. Definitely. I think it's the perfect road movie.
It's got all of the kind of melancholy, kind of, you know, self-growth and transformation that comes with being on the road. But plus, the vistas are just so unbelievably gorgeous. Is this your first time watching Paris, Texas, Marina?
No, I actually had watched it before. And it's one of those where, like, during, like, while watching it, you know, I'm not a huge fan of slow pace, especially if I'm watching something at home. Like, at the cinema, it's completely different. So, yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the slow pace, but after I'd first watched it, it's, like, one of those films that just, like, stayed with me and, like, further cemented itself, like, as, like, one of my favourite films. yeah, I think it's great. It's just one of those that you like just can't stop thinking about.
Yeah, it does feel that kind of culturally the things that cemented in people's minds was the image of Harry Dean Stanton wandering out, kind of, you know, abandoning his life, and then that image of Natasia Skinsky in that beautiful pink jumper in this strange kind of booth. But for me, watching it again, I was kind of reminded of all the wonderful bits in between, and I really think this is truly the most magical film. David, you're the one that chose this for Film Club. Why is that?
Well, I mean, one of the main reasons is that it is actually on re-release this week, so people can actually go and see it in the cinema. So handy, this is a handy service feature for our listeners. Also, I think that, like, actually in retrospect, it actually has quite a lot of overlap with one of our other films from the week, Hit the Road, I think. Specifically that a focus on a preteen boy who is maybe unaware of a situation that is going on between parents, and certainly there is overlap in the idea of depictions of quite lyrical father-son relationships. I had seen this when I was a teenager, and I think, you know, as with so many other great masterpieces of cinema, perceived masterpieces of cinema, I'd kind of watched it and was like, yeah, that was good. Next, you know, like, I'd not really, you know, taken it fully on board. And I mean, not because I wasn't trying to, but like, mentally was not able to at that age. And so seeing it again, like maybe 25 years later, was really interesting. I must say, it's maybe not one of my favorite Wenders films. There's an earlier film he did called Alice in the Cities, which I actually prefer. It's set in Germany. It's in black and white, and it's just a man and a young girl traveling through Germany. I find this film a little bit over sentimental sometimes, in its story and content. I mean, I think the idea of this character who is like obviously guilt ridden to this extreme degree and looking for some kind of, I think he's looking for some kind of forgiveness, but knows that he maybe doesn't deserve it. Is a fascinating kind of central conceit, and I think that the thing that really stands out for me in this film is like this new just the way it looks, like the colors, like this, you know, going back to Marina's comment about wanting to eat lava, you know, like these skylines, they're edible, you know, they have all these kind of like glowing reds, yellows, greens, like very primary. It's like it's like these candy colored vistas of the American landscape, which are very, very different to those that were seen in that were sort of immortalized in the westerns of the 40s and 50s. The film kind of exists in this space where, like, we're seeing urban sprawl out into the deserts, and you know, you're seeing like America, you're seeing American landscapes being overtaken by commercialism, and like, it kind of depicts that in a very loving way. Like, it's not cynical about commercialism and capitalism. It's very like, this is what America looks like now, you know, this is how like the light looks, you know, it's trying to kind of capture something, and you know, worth shouting out to the great cinematographer Robbie Muller, who made this film in a completely unique way. I mean, just also to self-publicize, I did an interview with Wim Wenders, which is on littlewhitelies.com, you can read, where we discussed how Robbie Muller shot the film and how Wenders restored it to try and get it to the colours that he was originally kind of trying to capture, and did so without the use of any kind of electrical lighting equipment. So like he was shooting in super, super low light, but capturing these incredible colours. And like, it's fascinating that, you know, there are, I can't remember who it was. I think it was like Jim Jarmusch or someone who's saying like, there are people who watch Paris, Texas, and they just, and like cinematographers. And I think it's one of the films that people don't know, like can't, you know, a cinematographer might watch a film and be like, oh, I see how they did that. But people can't get their head around how he shot it. I mean, it might seem weird to when you watch the film and think, oh, that's a beautiful landscape. But people can't understand how he was able to get those colours in the way that he shot it. So it's a proper kind of like mystery of cinema.
Yeah, we've had some real feast for the eyes this week. I think this is one of the kind of more beautiful weeks I've ever done on this podcast. There's been incredible use of colour. But yeah, even I mean, as much as those exteriors are absolutely stunning, I was kind of watching it again. I was taken by so many of the interior shots, just kind of the way that he's, I suppose we're so used to kind of murky films at the moment. So just kind of the way that he's able to just use interior lights. There's a scene with Justine Stockwell kind of laid out that's kind of shot in vivid green that, you know, if that was in a recent action film, there'd be 40,000 fans tweeting about it every day and how it was one perfect shot. And it's like just a throwaway in something like this. Marina, I'm just wondering though, I'm a big Harry Dean Stanton fan, and I always love how the late, great Roger Ebert always said that no film is wholly bad if Harry Dean Stanton is in it. Like, what did you think of him in this?
I think he was amazing. Agree. Big agree. But it's also how he's presented, his character is presented originally as this, you know, like, almost asking for sympathy, and then there's so much restraint in the storytelling and in the atmosphere, which slowly kind of presents him as, you know, you might be feeling sympathy for this man, but he is completely irredeemable. And, you know, picking up on what David said earlier about, you know, the father-son relationships in both Hit the Road and in Paris, Texas. I find that Hunter, the kid in Paris, Texas, is like a more like precocious iteration of the kid in Hit the Road. Like how this scene with the Super 8 footage, how he understands that version of his mum in that footage is just her in a film and not really her. And when he says to Travis that, you know, in those years that he was gone, he knew that he wasn't dead because he could hear him walking around. I just think, like, Sam Shepard did, like, an excellent job on the script. I just wanted more of Jane, I think, which like obviously captures the sense of like her loss and what the loss of Jane represents within the film. Like it captures that so beautifully because she retains this like mysticism and this like allure about her that like you just want more of her. But yeah, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah. The film kind of culminates in this incredible scene where Harry Dean Stanton is recounting the story, history of their relationship to her. And Jane doesn't have much more to do but to react. And perhaps, you know, with our modern lens, it does seem a bit, you know, Anna Paquin in The Irishman. They're just like, why do the women just have to kind of be silently judgmental? But I still think that is one of the most beautiful reaction performances that I can really think of.
I think in both cases, like, I think I disagree with you, Marina, on that. That in that, I think that her absence is what kind of is the thing that is dramatically driving Harry Dean Stanton, and like we're kind of with him on that journey because we don't know where she is and what she's doing, and the fact that the film refuses to kind of use flashbacks or all these or any kind of cheap devices, it means that you're kind of like you're there with him wondering what could have happened that would have literally caused her to like abandon her son. So
yeah, I think that that's the whole point, that it was good that I wanted more of her, because I couldn't have more of her in the film, because then it just wouldn't work if there was more of her in it.
Yeah, and it's strange because she is often kind of, what is remembered about this film, despite, I suppose it's that Hannibal Lecter thing of that, is he the lead actor, but he's only in it for like 6 minutes or something, just because of, the impact that she has. But yes, I mean, I think I'm going to, given that this being out in cinemas, I'm going to take the opportunity, certainly. I've only ever watched this on small TVs, and the idea of kind of getting to see these images on a big screen, I think it has to be done whilst it's still out. So if you've got thoughts on these films, email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, we'll be swapping a car for a bullet train before jumping on the train to Busan for Film Club. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Marina Asciotti. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.